There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Now, I'm joined this afternoon for our On The Couch show with the lovely Chastity O'Connell. Hello.
Hi, Helen. Thank you.
You just make me smile, Chastity.
You make me smile too.
And the balloons, obviously. You are the mental health counsellor at Human Relations Institute and Clinic, and you join us on a regular basis, and I love having you in the studio. I really, really do. I think you offer, obviously, fantastic expertise, but the way you talk about topics is so relatable and so inviting, and I think it's a really valuable time that we have together, and it's like my personal bit of therapy as well.
Oh, thank you so much for saying that. I enjoy being here, and it's always a pleasure with you.
Well, this afternoon we are talking about introverts, extroverts. There's sometimes a bit of a middle ground as well, but also shyness and social anxiety. And Chastity, you're on hand this afternoon to answer any questions or concerns that anybody might have around any mental health topics, but specifically we're talking about introvert shyness this afternoon. Now I'm going to play a little bit of music for you. How do you feel about that, Chastity?
Oh, I can't wait. Okay. I'm excited.
Bit of Bjork. Now, Chastity, we are talking about introverts this afternoon, extroverts, ambiverts. That was a new one to me. I want to start with introverts. Now, the two major personality types are extroverts and introverts, and they're known for having different, unique ways of people re-energizing and being motivated. And they each have characteristics of ways of interacting with the world and processing information as well. I just wanted to ask you, Are our brains wired differently if we have these two different personality types?
It's such a complex question to answer, in the sense, when we're talking about sort of brain processing, there's a lot of things we know about what goes on in the brain, and not just knowing that. We also know that there are so many individual differences. So it's this hard balance between, you know, saying, well, dopamine is on the reward pathway. Well, dopamine's implicated in a lot of other brain regions as well. So it's interesting that all this brain research has come to light, and our brains, to answer the question, they're wired differently.
Because all brains are wired differently.
Yes, yes. And so there are a lot of things in common. At the same time, there's so many points of why some people are more sensitive than others, or why some people are more resilient than others. And that can have to do with the sort of brain structures, the individual sort of components. If you're looking at the amygdala, it can have to do with processing. It can have to do with neurotransmitter transmission, you know,
which pathways have been reinforced from babyhood, really, a lot of the time.
Absolutely. Wiring and firing, to what extent those pathways have been stimulated and strengthened, but also how efficient is the transmission process of things like, you hear about dopamine, you hear about serotonin, norepinephrine. So to what extent those work the way we would like them to work also. So it's such a complex, and it's an awesome question that we could talk about for hours.
Now, in terms of extroverts and introverts, we would like to know what you are. And if you are curious as well, you can head over to our Facebook page and take the test. We're at DubaiEye103.8 to find out exactly what your personality type is. And don't forget to message us the results. Now, Chastity, what do you think you are in terms of introvert, extrovert, ambivert?
Oh, my goodness.
Where are you at, you think?
Well, what's interestingly enough, it's funny. Is it really interesting when you talk about yourself? I don't know.
Tell me.
So I remember taking a Myers-Briggs test years ago, maybe, could I say 15 to 20? No, not quite 20. Maybe 15 years ago.
For anyone who doesn't know, what is the Myers-Briggs test?
A Myers-Briggs test is, it helps evaluate your sort of style based on things like introversion, extroversion, judgment versus, off the top of my head, it goes over a number of things. But
and the way you fill out the form is there's a statement that you either strongly disagree with, agree, disagree, neutral, agree, strongly
yes.
agree.
Well
is that
said,
right?
Helen, yes.
Okay. And at the end, it's quite a long test, actually,
isn't it? It is.
And there's 16 different personality types.
Yes. Oh, see, you know this.
Well, I did it last night.
Oh, did you? Mm-hmm. Did you do the Myers-Briggs?
Do you want to know what I am?
Yes. Please tell me.
I'm an ENFJ, which is actually the same as Aisha, our producer.
Wow.
And it's commonly characterized as being called the dolphin, which makes me think of this kind of like really, you know, eager to please, you know, noisy character, which actually, do you know what? It's absolutely bang on.
Well, dolphin, who doesn't love a dolphin?
Well, quite. We all want to swim with the dolphin.
We all want to swim with the dolphin.
So, but I think that it's that insight. Why do we love labels so much? Why do we like to put a label on ourselves?
Ah, that's an awesome question. I think a lot of it, there's a couple ways to answer that. One, I think we love self-understanding and self-exploration, and it's something that we devote so pitiful little time to. So understanding ourselves, you know, we love being told about ourselves. I mean, we're not egotistical in the sort of pop psychology sense, but, you know, we are our perceptions, our experiences, you know, we're focused on our own survival. And so it makes sense that we would want to understand ourselves better. Labels also help us. We love labels. We love structure in the sense that it helps synthesize information. It's a heuristic. It helps us provide a kind of self-understanding as well. So
as a mental health counselor, do you get people go, Chastity, you know, tell me about me? A bit like in Friends, where Phoebe's dating the psychiatrist, and all the friends like, you know, define me, love me. You know, but you get people wanting that from you.
Yes, absolutely. And again, I think it has to do with this idea that we don't spend a lot of time doing it, but and we're curious about those hidden aspects of that people see that we may not see. And I think the job entails, what does a mental health counselor do? What does a psychologist do? Can you read my body language? Can you analyze my handwriting? Can you look at...
Can you?
Exactly.
No, but can you analyze my handwriting, Chester?
No, I cannot. Nor can I... Well, you can read body language a little bit, but it's not anything above and beyond what, you know, the average person might be able to ascertain as far as like facial expressions. And if someone looks at the clock, what does that mean? When someone looks at their watch, what does that
it's
mean?
It's normally me going, we need to go to a break.
Yes.
So don't read too much into that. Now, you said you did your Myers-Briggs test about 15 years ago. Do you think you'd get a different result if you were to do it today?
That is exactly what happened. So back then it was, I remember being an E and thinking, yes, that pretty much is bang on. But at the same time, I think I took it maybe a year or two ago, I can't quite recall, and I had gravitated toward the eye area, not quite dipping my toe into the eye pond and the introvert pond, but I was much closer to being an ambivert. So yes.
Well, Farhad's just messaged asking, can introverts become extrovert at a later time in life?
Can introverts become extroverts at a later time in life? Well, what we know about personality traits is that they tend to be fairly stable. So they kind of start getting set at around tweendom and adolescence, and they tend to stay that way over time. However, where people, I think, get confused with personality traits is that just because that's how you are, that means that's how you're going to be. And so we can predict from a person's personality trait how they might behave, but we cannot predict with any certainty in every situation. So can you have someone who's an introvert who is wanting to have a bigger social life? But what's interesting about that is I would take a step back from that and say, because introverts doesn't mean that they're wanting to be extroverts. It just means that they're energized by that time alone and they find, you know, peace in the quiet and in the solitude. So just asking that kind of question would make me wonder whether or not we're talking about shyness or social anxiety. And because if you as far as introversion and extroversion, they both have their benefits, they both have their drawbacks, but it really is, but can you have an introvert be, you know, sort of show wonderful social skills and have a great conversation? Absolutely. That's sort of what characterizes and distinguishes someone with introversion from someone who is shy, for example.
Chastity O'Connell from the Human Relations Institute and Clinic is joining me this afternoon for On the Couch. We're talking about introverts, extroverts, ambiverts, social anxiety and shyness. So if you've got any questions around these topics or know someone that would have a question to ask, get them to turn on the radio this afternoon. We're live in the Dubai Eye 103.8 studio. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some of the qualities of introverts, some of the benefits, as well as some of the most famous people in the world who identify as being introverted. Stay with us. Now, I really want to get into the topic of introverts. Trusty. I think there's lots of misconceptions, misunderstandings about introverts, but I feel like introverts perhaps had their best day, you know, in the past, you know, where times of deep thinking, you know, philosophers, writers were really held in very high esteem. So inventors as well. And Rosa Parks, actually a famous introvert. J.K. Rowling is a writer, very famous introvert. Barack Obama, in his first few pages of his memoirs, you know, talks about him identifying as an introvert. Can you give us a few facts?
Well, interestingly enough, it's, I think what happens sometimes when we look, especially, when we're thinking about like the poll, the non-scientific Instagram poll, I think part of that has to do with misconceptions about what an introvert actually is. And in some ways, the word introvert has taken on like a kind of negative slant.
It has. It's really interesting. I think people think of, attach it to behaviors rather than actually as a way of feeling as well. What would be your definition of an introvert?
An introvert is, so when we're talking about introversion, we're really looking at the quantity and intensity of interpersonal interaction. That sounds very stodgy definition, but we're looking at how much and how long a person interacts with another person and finds that either fulfilling, energizing, or depleting and exhausting. And it's this activity level, it's the need for stimulation. So we're not talking about, you know, whether someone's outgoing and social and someone's, you know, kind of hang a wallflower. Because that's literally, I think, when you sort of have a, you know, general understanding, you know, everyone, there's this ideal notion of the introvert, or sorry, excuse me, the extrovert being this outgoing social butterfly. In fact, social butterfly and wallflower, just those terms alone, I think are loaded with kind of messages. And interestingly enough, research-wise, there's great research on introversion where introverts tend to make better bosses. They are, and supervisors, they tend to allow people to speak. And anyone that's worked in customer service or any kind of sort of corporate environment realizes the importance of allowing people to feel validated, to feel heard. And people will work harder for someone that they feel validated by, and without the sort of without entering into things like money, promotions, praise. So introverts tend to make better bosses because they allow for this space for communication, and they have this time for quiet, reflective thinking, where extroverts tend to think out loud. Extroverts tend to sort of have this banter of back and forth, but what does that produce? So it's really important to understand the benefits and drawbacks.
So an introvert would perhaps speak more slowly, think more carefully before responding to a question, whereas an extrovert, as you say, would think out loud, be a bit quicker to reply, but perhaps might not offer as meaningful response?
Yes, how it plays out can vary, and that's one example of many. And it could be the person going into the boss's office and says, "Hey, can you talk?" An extrovert might say, "Sure," where an introvert might say, "Not right now, but can you come back in 15 minutes?" So they'd make space where they can receive that potentially. But that's one of many, many different ways that the sort of the behavioral aspect of introverts versus extroverts.
We have a clip here with Susan Cain. She's the author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, about the power of introverts and how you can really succeed in society with that extrovert bias.
Introverts have been taught to kind of fake it and to pass as extroverts. So it's not always easy to spot the introverts among us. My name is Susan Cain, and I recently wrote a book called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. I think at this point it's important for me to say that I actually love extroverts. I always like to say some of my best friends are extroverts, including my beloved husband. And we all fall at different points, of course, along the introvert-extrovert spectrum. Introversion is really about how you respond to stimulation, including social stimulation. So extroverts crave large amounts of stimulation. That's how they feel at their best. But introverts feel most alive and most switched on when they are in quieter environments. You know, Bill Gates is a pretty well-known introvert. Another interesting introvert, I think, is probably President Obama, who, you know, even if you look at the first few pages of his memoir, Dreams from My Father, he opens by talking about his love for solitude and how solitude is where he feels, in his solitude, he feels the safest. The ideal self in this culture is bold, it's alpha, it's gregarious, it's comfortable in the spotlight. And these values are reflected in our schools and our workplaces. So introverts are routinely passed over for leadership positions, even though the latest research by Adam Grant at the Wharton School shows that introverted leaders often deliver better outcomes than extroverts. But this feels really surprising to us because we imagine that leadership means being, you know, very dynamic and charismatic. What I really want to see is introverts starting to feel comfortable with who they are and not feeling like their personality trait is something to feel guilty about or ashamed of. You know, I think we have a real fallacy now that all creativity, all productivity comes from a very gregarious place. And I think that that's a real mistake. I mean, it's certainly a problem for introverts who don't prefer to function that way. But I think it's bad for the companies in question as well, because they're not getting the best out of people's brains if they're constantly throwing them together and not giving them the space to go off and find out what's inside their own heads.
Some really interesting insights there from Susan Cain, who's the author of the book Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Don't think the irony of me talking about this on the radio has not escaped me. I'm very aware of this. It's interesting, Jassy, we're talking about putting labels on ourselves, but I think it can be very useful to understand about a partner or a friend, in terms of what they identify as in terms of being introvert or extrovert. I remember going to a wedding when I must have been about 20, so my brother would have been 17. And we had one of those kind of, you know, mingles the night before the wedding with my cousins, and it was in France. And we didn't know many people, but everybody knew about us because my cousin was so like, oh, Helen and Michael are coming over. Mm-hmm. And she was so excited. And I remember my mum saying to my brother, now, Michael, people are really excited to meet you. And you need to, you know, socially, you need to talk to them. They're really excited to meet you. And my brother saying, Mum, you saying to me, talk to these people is like me saying to you, be quiet. And that was the first time I thought, actually, I hadn't even thought about him being a shy or an introverted person. But more importantly, I hadn't thought about the discomfort that would cause him to really go beyond his natural tendencies as in his personality. Mm-hmm. So I think it can be really, really useful to gain a really good understanding in what we're talking about this afternoon. And Chester, you're here this afternoon to answer any questions or concerns that people might have. I'm going to read a text to you now that's just come in. And as I said, it can be completely anonymous and we'll answer it when we come back. Anonymous message saying, my husband is a classic introvert and it can be very annoying and sometimes isolating for me. He has a few close friends, but doesn't like to have people over to our house or go out much and is always suspicious about meeting new people, even if it's through existing friends. How can I talk to him about this affecting me? We'll come back when we come back. Stay with us. Chastity, I'm going to read you this message again that came in. If you've got any questions or concerns for Chastity around mental health or specifically to our topic this afternoon, please do get in touch. My husband is a classic introvert and it can be very annoying and sometimes isolating for me. He has a few close friends but doesn't like to have people over to our house, go out much, and is always suspicious about meeting new people, even if it's through existing friends. How can I talk to him about how this affects me?
Well, interestingly, some of the things that are being described there, the idea that, having few close friends is somewhat can be somewhat typical for introverts, but not going out of the house and those kind of behaviors could indicate something else that's going on. And whether or not it's related to stress, maybe some underlying depression, shyness, social anxiety, it's important to sort of gain a fuller picture of what we're working with, because in and of itself, what the description is doesn't sound like it's solely attributable to being an introvert. At the same time, what I love what you've said is, how can I talk to him about how this affects me? And that's the basis for understanding his experience, because I think from the outside looking in, you know, it can be quite easy to attribute his behavior to hurting me. Like, he doesn't want to go out. Can't he see how much this means to me?
Yeah, or taking something away from her.
Yes. So it can almost feel like punishing. But if you knew that there was underlying depression going on, how might that change your expectations of what that person is able to offer at that moment? And I'm not saying it's depression or not. I want to be clear that you can't diagnose off of a 2-sentence text, but it's sort of making space for understanding this person beyond what is a label of introvert. And so it might be, you know, having a question or discussion about, you know, rather than, why don't you want to have people over? You know how much this means to me. Something like, well, I really enjoy when we have company. You know, what is it that bothers you about that? And keep in mind, communication is 70 to 90% nonverbal. So tone of voice matters. So being in a place where you yourself feel open and patient rather than irritated and frustrated will be way more productive. And being also in a position where you can communicate what's underneath that, which is you're wanting to have people over, potentially you want to feel connected, you want to feel part of a community. Those are all valid. But oftentimes when you look at arguments or disagreements between spouses, they stay at the superficial level, which is, he's hurting me, I feel punished, she's nagging me, I'm sick of the nagging, and it doesn't get to those deeper needs that are going unmet. And so there's a number of great resources that you can look at. Dr. John Gottman has some great resources for softening your startup, which means softening that startup.
So that's the first thing you say, how you get into that conversation.
Yes. And what, from his research, and part of what makes him so often quotable is that it's based on 30 years and thousands of couples and research across the world, and that I think it's somewhere between 93 to 96% of arguments can be predicted based on how they start, which is, why do you leave your shoes at the couch?
You always do. You never do.
Yes.
And what's, can you tell I'm speaking from experience?
Yes,
here?
We both are. But in any of those harsh startups that we use, which can be our go-to a lot of the time, if we sit back and think about it, no one's ever going to say to us, you know what? You're right.
always leave my shoes. I love doing that. Why wouldn't I?
Exactly. Or, you know what? You shouting at me so harshly has made me realize that, yes, I'm going to change my ways. So, and I don't mean to make light of it, but humor is also a very powerful therapeutic tool as well.
So what language or what words should we be using to kind of do an effective soft start, which I really like that phrase.
So soften startup is understanding the difference between criticism and a complaint. So that's a big part of it. We have a right to complain. If your steak is cold, if you're, you know, the not having people in the house is bothering you, you have a right to complain. Criticism is when it starts taking on a very personal tone, which is, you're an introvert, you know, where we start labeling, maybe we start blaming, you know, the reason why I'm so happy is because you won't let me have people over. But it really is boiling it down to the complaint, which is, I would like to invite people over. And how can we make this work where you don't feel, you know, first of all, what is it that you feel when we have people over? Well, it's expensive. I feel stressed. I feel like I'd have pressure to talk to them. Okay, so how do we work through this where we can honor your space? Maybe we'll only have a small dinner, a small group of people over for dinner. So it's looking for where the conversation can start to be productive, but acknowledging what is really the issue rather than the you always or you never.
Getting to the crux of it.
Yes.
Another message that came in on 4001 says, I've always wanted to ask this question to other mums. What do you do about your introvert kids? Mm. How do they overcome this whole embarrassment drama in a social circle? I do understand how my kid would feel in a crowd as I myself am an introvert, but is there a way I could help her ease up? Been more than a year since we moved here, and it's still such a big task every time we go out. Any tips highly appreciated.
Mm. Well, what's interesting, I think, is that gets back to the, is it introversion or are we talking about shyness and a bit of social anxiety? Introversion, again, is having to do with how a person feels energized, how a person, what their level of stimulation, their need for stimulation is. But when we're talking about how children feel, and particularly with regard to embarrassment, then we start looking at things slightly differently. And again, keep in mind that personality traits like introversion, extroversion, they don't get set, for lack of a better word, till adolescence and in adulthood. And in fact,
really?
Yeah, we don't talk about, we don't use personality personality assessments on children. You know, we don't use them on tweens up to a certain point. We can look at temperament when we're talking about babies. We're talking about temperament, which is innate, is something we're born with, where they're either easy, slow to warm up, or difficult.
I was told about having high and low intensity babies.
Oh.
Which I thought was quite an interesting way of looking at it. I think it's fair to say my first is very high intensity, so mm-hmm. gets upset very quickly, things escalate to screaming, but she's also very happy. And my second is very low intensity, just mellow.
Yeah.
Even when she cries, doesn't cry very loudly. So I think some of the personality, as you say, temperaments or traits that I've heard about around babies are things like being inhibited or mm-hmm. bold, mm-hmm. a bold baby.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've all met bold babies.
Sure.
But that's really interesting. But you wouldn't for a child say they're introverted or extroverted.
No, you could say that there's tendencies towards, again, you're looking at this balance between what is helpful and what is necessary. Is it necessary to label at that stage? Some diagnoses require a kind of label in the sense that it might aid getting the right treatment. Autism is a perfect example of that. Early detection of autism as early as possible is shown to have really much improved outcomes or better improved outcomes. But when we're looking at things like personality related characteristics, because there is so much of an interaction between the person's biological disposition, their inborn tendencies, and their interaction with the environment, what that environment calls out on them, and that interaction effect, you end up with a lot of variability. And that sort of interaction with the environment that takes place in toddlerhood, childhood, tweendom, it sets the stage for that later personality development. So it's really difficult. But getting back to the issue, you know, the child being an introvert, again, it's more important to look at what's going on. So is it that when you get into social situations, they turn beet red, they start shaking, they start crying? Or is it they feel like they don't know what to say? Is it that they're fearing? Is it anticipation of something going wrong? Is it that no one's going to like me? No one's going to talk to me? I'm going to say something stupid? That looks more as social anxiety, whereas whatever behaviors they're experiencing in the moment in those social interactions has to do with the shyness more than the social anxiety. Social anxiety is more anticipating something that's going to go wrong. But then when you're looking at shyness, does the child want that connection in that moment? And, or are we as parents in our wonderful quest to try to protect them, trying to put our assumptions and put our own discomfort at ease by, you know, we'll go out there and play. Well, you know, is it that the child wants to play but doesn't feel like they have the skills or feel like they're going to be embarrassed? Or is it that the child is like, I'm really happy playing with my Legos right now?
We all have moments, days, phases of being in that mindset of being happy in our own company. So what advice would you give to this mum who's worried about her daughter?
And she's 8, if I'm not mistaken. At this stage, it's helpful to have a conversation with them, but a nice conversation in the sense that maybe play a game of Uno where you have that discussion, you know, so and getting to know them as a person, because children change so much and they're in those from, you know, when they're toddlers to when they're teens, there's a lot of change that can go on. So asking the question, you know, what is it, you know, how do you feel when you are in a group? What's going on for you? So really understanding without trying to diagnose, but really understanding what their experience is. Is it that they're happy just having that alone time? Or is it, no, I really want to make friends, but I'm afraid everybody's going to laugh at me. And if that's the case, then it might be worthwhile to reach out to a professional just to get some tips on how to structure scaffold that their experience to set them up for success. And what I mean by that is giving them some tools, whether it be breathing exercises for dealing with the dysregulation, whether it be cognitive restructuring to look at how they think about themselves when they're in those social situations. So is it that they think, oh, I'm going to say something stupid and everybody's going to laugh at me, and you end up working with a little bit there? Or are they afraid of their own bodily reactions, like, oh, I flush, I turn red, I get sweaty, I stumble over my words? So
okay, hope that helps. I'm joined this afternoon by Chasti O'Connell, mental health counsellor, who's here to answer any questions that you have around any mental health issues. But we're talking this afternoon specifically about introverts, extroverts, shyness and social anxiety. Anonymous message that's come in here, Chasti, let me read this to you. I'm shy to this day and start feeling very nervous before meeting people. Recently been put in a position at work where I have to meet clients. I'm faking confidence, but the anxiety of being caught out and the anxiety of meeting the clients leaves me burnt out. I'm currently considering asking to be demoted, but can't bring myself to do it. Are there any practical things I can do to help myself?
Well, the first thing I want to say is, again, thank you for writing in, because your experience, you are not alone.
Far from it. I'm sure a lot of people in their cars, at home, will be nodding along to this. I think it's the classic thing, don't compare your insides to other people's outsides. I think you'd probably be surprised by how many other people are faking confidence all around you all the time, which is a small comfort, but it sounds like, I'm guessing it's a gentleman, this gentleman wants to feel more empowered in that work situation and probably embrace this promotion that he has deserved and received. So what can he be doing, Chastity?
Well, let me take just a few moments just to describe and identify what's happening. When we're looking at things like social anxiety, there's this sort of vicious cycle of, I feel anxious, my hands are cold and sweaty, I'm going to stumble over my words, I'm going to say the wrong thing. And then when we meet someone, we interact with them, maybe some of our language is a bit, you know, awkward, and maybe we are shaking a little bit in our voice, but ultimately we might get through it. We might, usually, yes, we get through it. And then afterwards, and here comes the cruel part, we start to replay everything we said and did. And so in that, and so when we do that, we're punishing ourselves and we are ruminating, oh, I should have said this. They're going to think I'm dumb. They're going to think I'm incompetent. I should just quit. And so the next time we go and meet someone, it just gets worse. So it's really important to understand the cycle of how this works. And when that happens, we end up avoiding social situations.
Or in this case, professional situations.
Exactly. Avoiding these professional situations. And what we also know about the treatment of social anxiety is we use exposure therapy. We're like, oh, you're afraid of that? Go and do more of it. You're afraid of saying something stupid? We're going to ask you to say something stupid and notice what your body does.
Like what?
Like,
Give me an example that you would give to somebody.
I would say,
yeah, I'm being serious. If someone came to see you at the clinic,
I can't say that. So I have a go to, but I can't say that one on air.
But, can you clean it up for me, Chastity?
Let me see. So another one could be something like just saying something that's wrong,
like factually wrong,
Like Paris is the capital of Poland,
with conviction to a stranger
And seeing, and it might not be as factually wrong as that. You might say something that is somewhat wrong. And what you're doing is you are reality testing. You're testing, so when I say this, what happens? Because my fear is looking stupid and saying the wrong thing. So if I say Paris is the capital of Poland, what's actually going to happen? Someone's going to be like, well, what are you talking about? Is there like a Parasovsky? Is there, you know, what are you talking about? And you get to experience your body, your physiological processing, that sort of fear response, that anxiety response, learns that, oh, when I say something dumb, it doesn't mean that everybody is going to not be friends with me and I'm going to lose my job, my wife, and my dog. You know, everything's going to be over, because that is what it's like.
It's catastrophizing.
Yes, absolutely. Or spotlighting. Spotlighting is one of my
favorites. Never heard of spotlighting.
Oh, spotlighting is a favorite. It's when you walk into a room and you feel really nervous and insecure and you think that everybody's looking at you, noticing how insecure and that you have no one to talk to. Nobody's noticing you. Everybody's too busy worrying about themselves. But spotlighting is this idea that everybody's noticing that I'm saying something wrong, that I'm doing something that's awkward. So
what advice could we give this gentleman? Because I strongly feel,
yes,
you know, I obviously do not know you, but I strongly feel you should not take yourself down from this position.
Absolutely, because that will just make it worse. You're feeding the beast in that sense. In a situation like this, I would definitely recommend seeing a professional to work with some more structured strategies on how to help you build steps toward bringing you closer to experiencing these stressful situations, but also understanding that that is your body's way of coping, and that coping response, that stress response, will get easier with more and more exposure. But in the meantime, there's breathing exercises, there's noticing your self-talk. What do you say to yourself before you go and meet a client? Don't screw this up. Everything's riding on this. You're going to look like an idiot.
Not helpful.
Not helpful. Although in our minds, we think that we might be giving ourselves the kick in the pants to knock it into, you know, first gear, but it really is psyching ourselves out before we even started. So looking at what we're saying before we go in, and even writing it down, get that stuff out of your mind. That's rumination. Get it out of your mind before you get there. And when you're in there, taking those mindful moments to try and stay rooted in the present, because what ends up happening is in that social situation, you are thinking about, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Did I say that? What am I going to say next? Where you're not actually connecting sometimes with the person that you're speaking with. So doing taking a deep breath, feeling your toes, wiggling your fingers, and coming back into the moment. And then afterwards, again, looking at that self-talk. How are you talking to yourself? How are you beating yourself up afterwards?
What about a few power poses, Chastity?
You know, whatever
I love
works,
a power pose.
Whatever works. Whatever works. You just made me like straighten my back a little bit and not hunch over. We're all, you know, straightening our backs. So power pose, why not? The reality is, when we're looking at helping people become more socially confident, there's things we recommend, and then there's the stuff that works, that's the right tool for them. And so that's part of what's important about that interaction and working with a professional, seeing what works. Because breathing exercises, they might feel, oh my gosh, what if they see me doing the breathing exercise?
And then do the power poses in the bathroom, by the way, anonymous. Because people will look at that outside the boardroom. I really, really hope that helps. And as I said, we do urge you to stay in this job that you really have deserved. We're talking about introverts, extroverts, social anxiety and shyness this afternoon. We have had lots of messages coming in around that. I'm going to read you one here. And as I said earlier, it can be completely anonymous, obviously a sensitive topic for some, so don't worry. Message here saying, how can you avoid social anxiety and fear of people judging you? Any tips would be very helpful. Thank you. I think everybody fears judgment, don't they?
Absolutely. And we judge.
Yeah, of course.
We do. And part of that is it helps us to sort of deal with life environments, life experiences. It's a shortcut. If we had to think objectively about everything that we did, we wouldn't be able to function as human beings. So I think part of it is sort of unpacking what judgment really is and taking the, it's can have a very negative impact, but understanding what it's there for. And understanding that all people do it. So how can you avoid social anxiety? And it's similar to what we were talking about with the earlier post, which is that which you are afraid of, expose yourself more to. So
you know, that's not what people wanted to hear, Chastity. No, people want to go, oh, can we not just press a secret button that's hidden somewhere on my back and then suddenly I'll be full of confidence and not worry anymore?
I would love.
It doesn't work like that.
No, if you have something, that would be amazing. And so again, it's this social anxiety. You're looking at building, you're looking at attacking behaviors. And so helping people to engage in the situations that they fear the most. You're looking at thoughts. What is it that you're thinking about? And you're also looking at physiological reactions, because when people are experiencing anxiety, it is almost as if there is a lion in the room with them. And you can't look at thoughts or behaviors without looking at the fact that your body might be freaking out in all sorts of ways, whether it's breathing fast, that
it's my heart pounding that I always get.
Yes.
I can feel it. I can physically feel it. Put my hand on my chest, it's about to burst out.
Sure.
And that can make you feel worse. You're going, okay, my body's freaking out. I must be doing it for good reason.
Sure. Well, and the way you just put it, you know, my heart is going to feel like it's coming out of my chest. This, you're experiencing something. And part of that is accepting that experience, that your body does feel that way. And unfortunately, what happens in social situations is that we attribute shame to it. And so, you know, when I'm about to talk with someone, my hands get really cold and clammy. And you go to shake hands with someone and you think, oh, they're going to realize that I'm nervous. I'm just meeting them for the first time. Of course I'm nervous. Of course I, you know, want to make a good impression. Of course. So it's this showing this gentleness and compassion with ourselves and with our body's response, which is awesome that it does that. It's like, oh, if I ever encounter that tiger, I am set. And so when we're looking at social anxiety, part of it is building the awareness of what is happening to us and looking at ways to cope in varying degrees with what is happening with us. As far as the judgment part, you know, again, there's two minds to that. One, which is people judge and it's a shortcut we use. At the same time, more often than not, people are criticizing and judging themselves more than they are you. So it's this building gentle awareness of, yes, there might be people judging me and I don't have to condone that judgment, but I'm just going to accept that that is what it is for right now. I'm going to make room for the judgment so I don't focus too much on pushing that judgment away. Because again, trying to push the judgment away, trying to push those thoughts out of our head takes us out of living our lives. We're too busy trying to, you know, say the right thing, do the right thing, give a good impression, that we're not ourselves anymore. Which again, when we're thinking about doing the postmortem on the social interaction, we're just going, oh, I can't believe I was so stupid.
It doesn't actually serve anything at all.
Yeah.
A message here, again, anonymous, if you prefer, we have no problem with that. A mum or dad, I'm not sure, saying, my four-year-old is worried people will laugh at him. He cowers in big or crowded places, won't go in or take part in sports events, even though he's very good at sport.
Well, that's great looking at the things that our children do well. That's really important to have that capacity to acknowledge what they do well. In that situation, there's a number of things that I think are worth mentioning. One is the experience of the four-year-old and understanding what is going on. And it sounds like you might have asked, you know, that there's this fear that people are going to laugh at him. What's also interesting is, where did that language come from? And as parents, sometimes we can give language in a way that may or may not reflect what is the child's experience. We're trying to understand. And so the cowering in bigger crowded places or not taking part in things that he enjoys, part of that is understanding a complete picture. And so are we talking about crowded places? Is it something that they're just sensorily, it is overwhelming? So it might be worthwhile, again, I don't want to pathologize or sort of diagnose child behavior, because there's this continuum, there's the spectrum of what is of normality. And I also appreciate that for certain periods of development, we have certain responses that are helping us cope with that, and we learn ways to overcome them. And so what I mean by going back to over-pathologizing, you might notice that I've been saying, well, see a professional. And that's not to say that I think something is wrong, but to have a complete picture of what's going on, because what the apparent impression might be, what your impression might be, is that, oh, he's, you know, social anxiety, he's shy, he's introverted, might have more to do with sensory processing than it does with an actual social interaction. And it might be, you know, some people are comfortable in crowds, some people aren't. So there's that part of your child developing where we're getting to know. So there's a lot going on with children.
Okay, there's a lot of messages coming in. If you'd like to have any questions or concerns addressed by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. When we come back, we're going to be asking if introverts and extroverts can live happily together under one roof. We've got a question asking just that. It's On the Couch, and we're talking about personality traits and types, talking about introverts, extroverts, ambiverts, social anxiety and shyness. Now, don't forget, this is your free clinic for some free advice, and you can, of course, remain completely anonymous if you prefer. It's your chance to have any questions or concerns addressed here live. Message that came in here, 4001 Chastity, saying, "Hello, I'm 18 years old and listening with my mother. I'm quite introverted, and we know what childhood experiences have led to it. My mother is asking if there's a way to change that at my age now."
And so when we're looking at things like, you know, identifying labels like introversion, one of my questions would be, how exactly do you know it's introversion and we're not talking about something else that has to do with shyness or social anxiety, for example? And it sounds great that you've done some exploration of the childhood experiences that have made you who you are today. That's so important. And we don't often get enough time to reflect back on who we are and where we've come from. And as far as trying to find a way to change that, I would look more at what are your goals and values rather than changing necessarily, because...
Well, that's really interesting, because I think the extrovert personality is held up as being something of an ideal.
Yeah.
And there are challenges and issues associated with being an extrovert as well. And it's certainly not wrong to be an introvert if that indeed is what you are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's benefits and drawbacks to either of the sort of personality types. And so, you know, if we're looking at what, you know, why the discussion has come up, why is it looking at that you're quite introverted and you're wanting to change it? Is it because you're looking for more social connection and not having the skills or having the sort of bodily responses that seem to be getting in the way? Or is it that you're looking to be more confident in school? Is it that you're feel like you're withdrawing socially? So looking at what is it you're trying to accomplish, what is it that you're interested in doing, and that's going to give us an understanding of what tools and resources will help you. If it is about social connection, then it might be looking at how do we understand what your fears are and help you navigate those and keep you, you know, on the road toward still interacting with that which you may be avoiding. And so that's sort of very stodgy language for saying, you know, how do we keep you from withdrawing socially, if that's what this is about? If it's about confidence, then there's different tools and resources to build that confidence. So my question would be more about, what are you hoping, where are you hoping to go with this, rather than changing the introversion, because that may not ultimately get you where you want to go.
Okay, I hope that helps. Now, we need to talk about extroverts as well. We've talked a lot about introverts this afternoon, and I really just want to get your definition of an extrovert. My understanding is it's somebody who gets energy, feels recharged by being around people, is comfortable in crowds, naturally social and outgoing. Is that fairly accurate, or is there more to it than that?
That sounds great.
Oh, it's, thanks.
Yes, well done. Yeah, it's you've hit the nose on the head. It has to do with, you know, being sociable, active, talkative, optimistic, fun-loving. There's a lot of...
That's all really positive language, though.
It is.
Whereas I feel like there's more negative language that's used around introverts.
Yes. And I think that has a lot to do with us, our societal expectations and societal connotations on the language that we use for introverts. If we were in China or Japan, for example, that the idea of being reserved, reflective, quiet, retiring,
thoughtful,
those are incredible tools. In fact, I think that's part, you see this, although I'm mixing a couple of things, you see this return to mindfulness, which is taking a moment out of the ever-present, non-stopping world, excuse me, and connecting with what's going on internally within us. So there's definitely benefits. And you're right, there is a lot of positive language, but I think that has to do with our societal interpretation.
I think so. It's interesting because studies have shown that talkative people are rated as smarter, better looking, more interesting, more desirable as friends, and velocity of speech counts as well as volume. Apparently, we rate fast talkers as being more competent and likable than slower talkers. But I wondered is the modern workplace perhaps skewed a little bit in terms of kind of providing an advantage to extroverts? You know, a lot of us work now in open plan offices. We've had people messaging in today talking about anxieties around speaking up in meetings if they're a naturally shy or introverted person, collaborative learning rather than quiet study. So it does feel like perhaps society is favouring extroverts a bit more.
Sure. There's this reality, this practical reality, that with an extrovert, you either know what you're getting or think you know what you're getting because it's out there. It's present as far as communication, it's present in language. And we're so dependent on language and as far as understanding other people. And with introverts, it's not that there's something negative, but there's potentially an absence of information on which we can draw assumptions and judgments. And as human beings, we live based on our assumptions, judgments, heuristics. This helps us function in a world where we are bombarded by stimuli.
It's trying to make sense of that.
Yes.
And introverts can be a bit more mysterious.
They're very mysterious.
I'm the least mysterious person in the world. As we said earlier, I'm a dolphin, basically, according to the Myers-Briggs test.
Yes.
We'd love to hear what you are this afternoon. If you've been onto our Facebook page, that's Dubai I 103.8, do the personality test. But in terms of challenges facing extroverts, you know, we talk about people being loud and social, open. And I think perhaps extroverts are seen as maybe being more mentally strong. And that's, of course, not always the case, or perhaps even being seen as less sensitive or thoughtful or considerate. So we do tend to take these stereotypes for both in, you know, extreme directions. I'm going to read out a message that's come in. 4001, to have any of your questions or concerns, queries, or just want to have your say this afternoon, 4001 or the Dubai Eye Messenger app. Fort Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Anonymous message come in saying, my partner is really an introvert compared to me, a full extrovert, and in contradiction to the saying opposites attract, this is not an easy combination and very, very difficult and exhausting. What to do? Chastity, any insights on that?
In some of these, there seems to be a pattern of using the label of introvert and having that be the reason why there's challenges or disconnect in relationships. And certainly it can be difficult for extroverts to appreciate that introverts need their quiet and alone time. And it can be difficult for introverts to understand that extroverts need that social language engagement.
Yeah, that buzz.
That buzz. Exactly. It's where they get their spark. And when your sparks are in different places, sometimes that's difficult to find a challenge in finding that alignment. You know, it really is important to understand what else is going on in the relationship. In the same situation when we're talking about the 18-year-old and the couple, what else is going on? Because it may not be that being an introvert is the full story.
When we come back, we'll be offering some practical advice for how to speak to your partner and try and gain some deeper understanding. Stay with us. We're talking about social anxiety, shyness, introverts and extroverts this afternoon and on the couch. And we've had a number of messages coming in actually on the topic of marriages where one is an introvert and one is an extrovert. And I can openly say my husband is definitely more of an introvert than me. And it's never what I, you know, when you're growing up and you think, oh, I'm going to marry a man who's like this. And in my mind, I was going to marry someone who's like, you know, 12 years older and life and soul of the party and, you know, a real extrovert. And my husband isn't like that at all. He's kind and quiet and considered. And that's what I need. Interestingly, that's the balance that I need. But sometimes that dynamic isn't working. And the message that we had in earlier, Jessie, I'll read it out again, says, my partner is an introvert compared to me, a full extrovert. And in contradiction to the saying opposites attract, this is not an easy combination and very, very difficult and exhausting. What to do?
Mm. Yeah, and it's, I'm always hesitant to pointing and pinning it down to one thing, not to say that there's more issues that are going on, but introvert, extrovert, that is one piece of information about where you find and derive your energy, what kind of demands you have as far as the quantity and the intensity of the interaction. But at the same time, things like miscommunication can have multiple sort of factors that are involved, not just relegated to introversion. It could have to do with, you know, if there's underlying stressors in the marriage, if there are work stress feeding over, are you able to spend quality time with each other? What does the quality of your communication look like? How do you talk to each other? And of course, if one partner is struggling with some type of psychological challenges at the moment, that can also impact the marriage. So it's really important to have a very holistic view of what's going on, because oftentimes it's not just one thing. It's not just he's an introvert, I'm an extrovert, and that's what our problem is. It's many interconnected factors related to each other.
Okay, I hope that helps. Message here from Shan saying, not sure if it fits the discussion point, but the nature of a personality, either introvert or extrovert, depends on the group you're in. I tend to shut myself up if I know that the group is not an appropriate place to express, but another scenario is I'm all over outspoken and expressive. I think that's very true.
Yeah.
If I'm with people I know well, then I can't shut me up. But, you know, if going into a situation where I don't know anybody or I'm intimidated by people, then, you know, totally clam up.
Sure.
I think that's pretty, is that pretty normal? Yeah, look at me, look at me, look at me going, am I normal?
Yes, you are normal.
Like there's such a thing as normal.
Exactly. But I think that highlights an important thing to point out. In this discussion, we're talking about one of five sort of scientifically considered personality traits. Introversion and extroversion is only a slice of personality.
Give me the five.
The five. Well, it's a wonderful acronym.
I love an acronym.
Yes. Who doesn't love an acronym? It can be canoe or ocean. Yeah. So it depends. Oh, you can have your canoe on the ocean.
I like it. Let's go with canoe.
Okay. So canoe. The C is for conscientiousness. And this deals with things like it assesses an individual's degree of organization, persistence, level of motivation, and getting things done. and to that at the end. So there's conscientiousness, there's the, so what comes out, kanu, a, so agreeableness, and agreeableness assesses the quality of one's orientation along a continuum from compassion to antagonism. So to what extent are you sort of soft-hearted, good-natured, or more suspicious, rude, uncooperative? And rude sounds negative, and it can be. At the same time, we need people that just slice through the, you know, the chaff and get to the wheat. We need people that slice through the noise and get to the signal. So it's not like these are always negative. There's openness. Oh no, I skipped. Neuroticism. So it's neuroticism. This has to do with assessing a person's emotional instability. Are you prone to worrying, nervousness, insecurity, or are you more calm and relaxed and hearty, secure, satisfied? And then, of course, the last is extroversion and introversion. And so you can see quite quickly that when you take other personality factors into account, how they can easily account for some of the challenges that were described in the previous messages that came in. So saying your husband's an introvert because he doesn't want to have people over, does that really have to do with how his need for interpersonal stimulation, or does it have to do with him being open or agreeable to the experience? And so that's why there's a hesitation on my part, and it's difficult to talk about, is this extroversion? Most of the time, I'll say that our classic, our favorite psychological response, which is, it depends. Yes. And that's what, and it's unsatisfying as an answer.
Because as we said, we all like labels. We all generally like a diagnosis because we know what we're dealing with. That helps us make sense of the world and then tackle a problem with hopefully a solution.
Absolutely. But
it's not always that straightforward.
No.
I did see a news story I'd like to run past you. Mm-hmm. Conscientious extroverts are less at risk of depression and anxiety, claims a study. So individuals who are both highly extroverted and conscientious may be protected against depression and anxiety. It's a new study at the University of Buffalo, who looked at examining combinations of personality traits, which I think is actually really, really interesting. Basically, what they found was people who have this combination of being conscientious and an extrovert, these traits kind of manifest in a way that, well, as you said, they're known as part of the big five. So typically a person who's highly extroverted is very sociable, surrounds himself with people. Meanwhile, a very conscientious person tends to express high levels of self-discipline and favours making detailed plans over spontaneity. When the two are combined with neuroticism, it's someone who's more susceptible to experience negative emotions. But when these two are together highly, it means that they're better equipped because they can engage in meaningful social interactions and find them rewarding, so they're lower risk of mood disorders. And if they're being conscientious about it, they can strive towards goals and putting plans in action. So it sounds like you, as an extrovert, you're going to be around people, you're able to reach out to people, and if you're conscientious, you're motivated about putting plans in place to address any issues that you've got. So it's a happy combination, it seems like. I don't know who got it.
It's nice and beautifully put. I mean, it makes sense when we look at how, you know, the various treatments of things like depression. And there's sort of the psychodynamic orientation. There's cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. There's ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy. And they all have their various approaches on how depression happens and what to do to help someone feel better. At the same time, there's also different tools and techniques, one of those being behavioral activation, which is very much what you described with regard to conscientiousness, this idea that you are helping someone structure their world in a way to keep them interacting with the factors in their life that are going to help improve their sort of emotional, and we know depression is way more than just emotions, but for brevity's sake, we'll say emotional well-being.
I want to come back to shyness, because I think most people, the vast majority of people, have experienced shyness, and the studies have shown that 62% of people apparently feel shyness daily. I'm shouldn't say this, but I'm always a bit suspicious of people who say that they haven't experienced shyness. You know, those people like, oh yeah, I'll go up to that person in a bar and ask them out, or I'll go up to, you know, I'll ask for it. You know, I'm always a bit like, oh, I don't know how you would do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I find that really freaks me out. So to my mind, the kind of default kind of mindset is feeling a little bit anxious, feeling a little mm-hmm. bit shy, feeling intimidated by situations. And I assume that that's the norm for other people mm-hmm. as well. But can we explore what shyness really is?
Sure. Shyness. It is such a difficult concept to define because there are a lot of theories about it and not everybody agrees on them. And at the same time, we know it's pervasive. It's everywhere. And so I think for the purposes of our time here today, we'll consider it like an emotion, which like emotions, they have continuums. And, you know, and to give sort of an example or comparison, let's look at we could look at sadness, and there's degrees of sadness where, you know, the sadness can prove extremely helpful. Or when it's prolonged and it takes us out of living, it's a clinical, you know, it becomes depression. And the same thing with shyness. There's having that experience of being reserved, hesitant in situations, which has an adaptive function. You know, it's not necessary to go into every situation feeling like you understand and know what's going on and that you can be your vulnerable self. I mean, it makes sense that you would have some aspects of you guarded. And then there's parts where it becomes dysfunctional, where it keeps you from living. And what's interesting about shyness is that it's not introversion. Introverts, just as introverts, are happy and, I should say, comfortable with their degree of social interaction. They have the social skills that they need to feel functional, and they use them when they need to.
I really like this quote from Audrey Hepburn. It says, I don't want to be alone. I want to be left alone. But I think that's quite interesting in terms of that choice.
Yes.
I think that's what we're really getting at. When we come back, I want to ask you about the difference between shyness and social anxiety. Lady Gaga's Applause. We are talking about extroverts this afternoon, introverts, shyness and social anxieties. I'm joined on the couch by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Now, we have had lots of questions about shyness this afternoon, mm-hmm. and I just want to get to the bottom of what's the difference between shyness and social anxiety, Chastity?
So shyness is that emotion, and that so there's a connection between shyness and social anxiety. But shyness, it's like the same as if we're considering the definition of shyness being an emotion, it's just like sadness, anger, fear, things that are there to protect us. They're adaptive in the right amounts. They're necessary for our survival.
Whereas social anxiety would be a type of anxiety disorder?
Well, yes, absolutely. And it's the sort of when shyness goes off the rails and it impairs our ability to function, make social connections. And what's interesting is that people with social anxiety disorder, I feel like I need to say this as well, they'll still have, it's not like agoraphobia, it's not withdrawing socially, it's that the experience of social situations is painful. They still want them. They still strive
for them. So still craving that social interaction, but are fearful of putting themselves in that situation for fear of judgment?
Fear of judgment, fear of making a fool of themselves. I'm using a lot of words that I've heard clients use, so this is not my language necessarily, because I think it's important to impart that, to connect. So people connect with, you know, yeah, I know what it feels like to make a fool of myself, or I know what it feels like to feel like I've, you know, replay the social situation over and over my head and have felt, oh, that I did something wrong.
I think we've all done that.
Yeah.
4001 or message us on the Dubai Eye Messenger app to have your say or to ask any questions of Chastity O'Connell here this afternoon. Message that came in saying, I'm a pretty outgoing person and to be honest, can sometimes find shyness rude in social situations.
Mm.
That's a really interesting insight actually, because I think some people, if you are naturally gregarious and outgoing and chatty, to see someone who is struggling in a social situation who might be naturally quiet and struggle to interact with people, to misinterpret or interpret it as rudeness.
It's, again, it's that idea that when you're looking at extroversion, there's the assumption that you know what that person is thinking because they're speaking. With introversion, especially with shyness, particularly when you can see the struggle, it can, you know, we can misinterpret it in all sorts of ways. And ultimately, when we're looking at things like shyness and social anxiety, I think it's really important to understand that telling someone shy to speak up or asking someone who has social anxiety disorder, just get out there, is the equivalent of asking someone to, why don't you just change your eye color? And yeah, you can go get some contacts, but yeah, that's only just
sort of...
Are you
really addressing it?
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you what role technology has played in terms of shyness and social anxiety.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question.
Oh,
and it's interesting in this, in our time together, talking about things like introversion, extroversion, shyness, and social anxiety disorder. As what's the role of technology? So think about the last time you were in an elevator.
About 2 hours ago.
And what do most people do when they're in the elevator with you?
I don't mind talking to people in elevators. My husband has a no talking rule. Even if I ask him a question, he'd be like, discuss this when we get out. It's really weird.
So, and think of the last time you were at a doctor's office. Mm-hmm. Did you read the magazines? You know, think about when you were getting the coffee. Did you make small talk with the, you know, coffee attendant?
I've got two young kids. If I've got 5 minutes on a sofa, I'm going to be catching up on my Instagram. Thanks very much.
And you know, in a lot of ways, I think my scenarios are not necessarily relevant for you, Helen, because, you know, you have the perfect answer for all of it, which is, you know, I like to talk in elevators, but in a lot of ways, when there's some, when we get into an elevator, we're in their doctor's office, when we're, even when we're walking in the mall and someone is approaching us opposite to us, we oftentimes, sometimes, go to our phone to avoid that eye contact, that sort of awkward, unusual feeling that happens inside when we feel that there is a social expectation to interact with people. Think about it. An elevator is a weird concept. Like, you're crammed into an elevator with a bunch of people and you're all pretending that no one else is there.
So true. I think the same about cinemas when I think about it objectively. I'm like, that's weird to be sitting in a room literally inches away from a stranger just watching something fictional.
Yes.
But it's weird when you come out of those situations. But as you say, an elevator where you, there's a false intimacy there, isn't it? Where should you make conversation, shouldn't you? And the safest thing is to get your phone out and look down.
Get that phone out.
And get your phone out and then look down on the so-called exciting things that other people are doing, which can often make you feel rubbish.
A little dopamine hit. And what's unfortunate about those moments is that we're missing out on those micro moments of understanding that human relationships are awkward and everybody else is feeling the same way too. So we're losing that commonality, but we're also avoiding that sensation of that awkwardness.
We're distracting ourselves from it.
Absolutely. And so when you go to a social event and you walk in and you're, rather than saying, hi, I'm, you know, or trying to find where you get your name tag from, whatever social event it might be, you look at your phone until you find something comfortable. So we're avoiding those sensations. And what that's actually doing is sort of robbing us of the messiness and awkwardness and beauty of human interaction. There's a quote from a book that I want to just take a minute. It's like a sentence or two from Sherry Turkle's book. It's called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. And she says, human relationships are messy. Are rich, messy, and demanding. When we clean them up with technology, we move from conversation to the efficiencies of mere connection. And so this idea that, yes, we may be communicating more efficiently, more effectively, but are we connecting? Are we, you know, appreciate and understanding that everybody feels this. And again, if we're looking at how we treat social anxiety disorders, that exposure therapy. So you would tell the person, go on the elevator and make small talk with someone, you know, ask the coffee attendant how her day has been, and feeling that sensation of what it's like to feel unusual.
So embrace the awkwardness, people.
Embrace it.
Chastity Connell, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, Human Relations Institute and Clinic.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.